you tell me roughly when you became a member of the Stock Exchange Council?
Oh dear.
Was it 1950s, 1960s?
I should think it was about, when did I retire? I retired in about 59. I should think it was about 50 to 55, something like that.
And how did that come about?
Well, nearly every big firm used to have somebody on the council, and it was generally suggested that I should go. I can't remember the particular reason, whether there was a reason to do with the gilt-edged market or what reason, but I consented that I would do it for a bit, and I did it for about 5 years. I didn't then realise quite what it involved.
What did it involve at that time?
Well, it involved an enormous amount of reading at weekends, but it also really involved things for which I wasn't trained to really know anything about. I mean, my contribution from my very narrow experience wasn't really of much use, except from a common sense point of view, to the council, because most of the business they were talking about was something right out of my ken, and therefore I couldn't see it unless something to do with the gilt edge market came up or some common sense question. I was really irrelevant and never felt that I really made a useful contribution on most of the subjects.
How did it affect your involvement in the firm's business?
Very much so, because jobbing is a thing from moment to moment, and I used to actually hate taking days off. I didn't mind how much holiday I took on end, but you could take one day off and you might just as well have taken a week or a fortnight if there was a dramatic move in prices. It'd take you 4 days to get back into it. Well, the council was rather like that, except that you were always having to go up and you'd miss some important point. And looking back on it, I think one ought to have given up trying to run a book altogether. The two did not combine. If you're running a book, it's essential to be there when you're running it virtually all the time.
At some stage, you'd taken complete charge of the government book.
Yes. Nick Wilkins and I ran it together, but the technical side, yes, I think really from shortly after I took it over, I was responsible for running, and till towards the end when I handed over to a boy called Michael Everson, who I knew was going to succeed me in running the book, I let him do a great deal of the running of it. But for all the main time, till a bit after I joined the LACA, yes, I virtually ran it when I was there.
And again, did you adopt any particular approach to running the book?
No, purely opportunist.
And what kind of capital did you feel you required to adequately run the book?
I never felt I was short of capital, but I had a ceiling in my own mind. When I was uncomfortable, it had got bigger than that, whatever it might be at a certain time. It was obviously related in some way to capital, but more to my own mind. If I got a position bigger than I cared to deal with, well, then I would do something about it. Relative to capital terms, I don't think there was any particular figure. And as the market got bigger, one naturally got bigger positions. But I know mentally, I used to be quite happy with something at some figure, and then it got bigger in some sort of figure, and then I would be unhappy and I would have to do something about it. I never felt that if you gave me another 50 million capital, I would make you more money.
About how many of you were on the government book?
4.
And what was the chain of command when you were in charge? Did you keep a fairly close eye on what was going on? Did you expect everyone to be referring back to you?
In ordinary times, you probably could. In a really busy time, no, you couldn't. And I probably didn't know my position by the end of the day within several million. It was impossible because all 4 of you were flat out dealing probably with queues on occasions. when there was a new tap stock that was very much in demand or something of that sort. We read it, but you tried to keep it in the back of your mind that overall, if it was going up, you knew you had some stock on the book, or if it was going down, it didn't get too big or something. But no, you couldn't. In busy times, you could only keep an overall, but you were very close and used to whisper to each other what you were doing. It was very often difficult. Several times forgot to book a bargain in a million or two in busy times.
Did that ever create problems?
Small.
Now, what were your attitude to the brokers who you were dealing with? Did you feel you had to be fairly sharp because they were?
Oh, there were one or two of them that you had a reputation that you had to, but mostly, no, it was a position of pretty good trust. They trusted you and you trusted them.
Can I ask you what a typical day would have been like for you at this stage in your career during the 1960s, for example? Where were you living at this time?
Where was I living?
Yes.
I was living in Hampshire. I used to catch the 7:25, I think, in the morning. And I used to get back home about, I used to catch 5:30 or sometimes 6 o'clock, get back in the evening. I actually started dealing earlier. It used to be nobody dealt before 9:30 because the government didn't operate till 10 o'clock. I then found that if there was a thing like a tap stock or something, if you dealt earlier, you could do much better because they couldn't go to anybody else really because the government wasn't operating. So we very often made most of our money between 9:15 and 10 o'clock because you more or less had the government broker buttoned up as to what he was going to do with you at 10 o'clock. So I started and bitterly regretted starting the earlier because once you started, of course, then somebody else went over and then you got this awful thing of it opening up. And I think eventually the government broker, I can't remember, was forced to deal a bit earlier, I can't remember.
And what was the daily routine like? Were you reading the newspaper on the way into work?
Yes. Funny enough, I had a flat in London, which I had to at that time, but I commuted when I could. I was far better informed when I commuted than where I was when I lived in London, because it was vital to know what all the press said. I took all the relevant papers, and it was vital to know in the morning what they said, because it did colour the market for the first hour, and that made your position right or wrong for the day. I found living in London, you were less well prepared to do it.
Would you go into the office first in the morning, or would you go straight to the house?
Oh, always into the office first, always. Yeah. And then you plan your day in the office. You might change your mind, but you virtually plan the day in the office, what you were trying to do.
Would you take a break for lunch during the day? Would you be too busy?
Oh, yes, always. The thing usually went dead between 1 and 2 and didn't start up again, unless it's exceptionally busy time, didn't start up again really till about 3 o'clock.
And about when would you be leaving the house?
Well, the house closed at 3:30, but you often did a lot of dealing in the office afterwards.
Was dealing in the office any different to dealing face-to-face, or did you
yes,
feel
it
you were
was.
Basically doing the same thing?
Some of it was advantageous, some of it wasn't. You didn't, of course, know what your rivals were doing. In the stock exchange, you could see your favourite broker talking to the opposition. You didn't know really what had gone on the telephone.
Would you meet with your other partners at some stage during the day?
Well, you were all huddled together in the stock exchange, so you were next to each other all the time. Really. One of the advantages on telephone was in busy times, the telephones would become jammed, and if they got on to you, they dared not deal with you, with a client on the other end, because it might take them 10 minutes before they could get through to the other shop. So it worked both ways.
Could you briefly describe now what happened with the firm after you'd merged with Webb de Lacquer, or what happened with your career? You retired in the early 70s. So did you stay on the same book?
I stayed on the same book. Life went on much the same, but the whole atmosphere changed then because we got involved with Rothschilds. Rothschilds, you probably know, bought 15% of Red Lacquer. And therefore we had outside contacts, and the Lacquer were quite different because they were in different markets. They used to have a big entertaining room, and then people would come in and drink in the evening and discuss business. We never did anything like that, and we just has advantages, had its disadvantages. It upset quite a lot of younger people's private lives. They used to sit and talk business and perhaps drink too much in the evenings, and their wives would get browned off. We never suffered from that. We always said we went there to do business, and we had no, other than perhaps asking somebody to lunch or something, we had no luncheon rooms in Redgerston. But the Lacquer was a much bigger concern and run on quite different lines. I'm not saying it was better, or I'm not saying it was worse, it was just quite different. And therefore it was a big change for us to go into there. And it's not a change that I enjoyed.
As equity jobbers, did they have a different ethos? Did they think about jobbing in a different way?
I think they were harder work because equity jobbers had to know the background of their companies. We only had to know the background of the government, and all government stocks are the same with their different peculiarities. Whereas if you're dealing in the equity market, then you had to know all about the management of the company. Yes, it's quite a different ball game. But the same flair, I would have said, went all the way through. But there was much more to be learned. You had to know about your companies much more than equity market. Mm-hmm.
So during the early 70s now, you were beginning to think about retiring and finishing your career in the city.
Yes, very much so. I always meant to retire when I could because I had a horror of staying there too long. Anyhow, I think if you've done that sort of job for long enough and been through the hard times and the good times and everything, you get less good at it. You get more sedate, more, you know, want to keep what you've got.
So roughly when was it when you retired?
It must have been, what are we now, 15 years ago, I suppose.
So that's about 1975.
Yes,
had you moved into the new house by that stage?
I hadn't moved into this one. No, I was still at the other one. I moved into this one after I retired.
Mm-hmm. And what about the house in the sense of the stock exchange? Had you moved into the new building, the new stock exchange?
Yes. I had some time, but not very long in the new building. Yeah.
Had reviewing now the whole span of your career, had jobbing changed in any way, the actual business of standing on the floor of the house and trading day in, day out?
No, I mean, it increased enormously in value, in volume. But now the principles of it, I think, it was a very rapid change towards the end, I suppose. But no, I think the same principles and things went on as before. Firms got very, very much bigger. It was a big amalgamation. Whereas before, it was just a small firm doing one type of business. It then got much bigger with merchant banks and really Bank of England and things involved with the finances of the firms and all that sort of thing. Yes, it did change in character, I suppose.
Did the attitude to jobbers change? You mentioned earlier that jobbers were regarded as being...
I don't think so. I think, well, brokers and jobbers became more or less the same category, whereas before perhaps jobbers had been considered the inferior of the two. I think it was still considered, any rather slick people went into the... rather the same as the whole city. People not in the city are rather inclined to think the city's a place which lately has been proved to be rather so. But It was pretty straight in the times when I did it. There were various people. There was one chap I remember who wouldn't deal with you if he had a big order, unless you put 10,000 shares down to him before the deal started. But there was very little of that, very little of it. But of course, in the way old days, without mentioning names, the big fortunes were built up by people who contacted the Prue or whatever it was and knew that they were going to buy a tenth of Marks and Spencer or whatever it is, and they helped themselves on the way. I think that was, I don't think anybody thought anything of it, and talking way back. But of course, looking back on it now, it was very much frowned on today. But I think some of the fortunes on brokers, not jobbers, brokers were made on the back of what big clients were doing in the early days. They knew they were going to buy a proportion, and I don't think there was no law against buying something yourself. I suppose it was inside information. Never heard the word inside information, I don't think, till comparatively recently.
What would you say in retrospect had been the main strengths of the jobbing system?
I think because it was one of the few really free, genuine free markets, which you lived or lost by your wit, rather than your brain.
Would you say it had any weaknesses?
Yes, I think it did, because it depended a lot on how you got on with particular peoples of power. And there were some people, without mentioning names or anything, who wielded in the broker angle or their minions enormous power, which could make or break something. I think that was, I don't think it was ever exploited, but it was there. And it was very, very necessary to get on well with certain people. Otherwise they could finish you, yes. I think that would be a weakness. It was in the hands of, I'm really talking about the Gilt-edged market more than the other thing. The government broker was definitely very much all powerful, and his people under him, the dealers.
Had you found jobbing a risky career?
Oh yes, without question. Without question.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Hmm?
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? In what sense was it risky?
Take for example the year after we took over, when I actually owed, I know, doesn't seem much money now, but it was in those days, I reckon I owed £20,000, and I walked up and down the house we had then, which was near Basingstoke, which I bought for £7,000, mortgaged it £4,000, I remember it four, extortionate price of 4%. My wife and I walked up and down deciding whether we ought to sell it and rent something. Sounds small beer, but it was not in those days. And one went through agonies, yes, absolutely. But I think this isn't, if you're playing for biggish fish, which I suppose we were in those days, you have big risks with it. And I think if you've been through the mill, you're probably better at the game than those who just take on something when it doesn't really matter. I think I wasn't only worried about myself. I thought, you know, all the clerks who I all knew, I knew how many children they had. We were all, you know, all worried, and where we write to, and what we to tell the people whose money was in the firm, because in those days you didn't ever send them a company report or anything. What we to tell them that they were, oh yes, there were great risks involved. I always knew there were big risks involved.
Would you have ever advised your children either for or against going into a career in the city or into jobbing if they'd ever come and asked you?
No, I had two sons at the time. I hoped that not more than one would go into the city, but actually they've both gone in. One's in Henderson administration and the other is in Red Lacquer. I tell them, quite frankly, you know, if you've got a big brain, for goodness sake, don't go into stock change, because you'll do very well somewhere else. But if you're average or less than average, it's quite a good place in the city to be able to possibly make enough to do the things you want to do in life. Brilliant.
Finally, what would you describe as the qualities required to be a successful jobber? Perhaps thinking about your own personal experience or the experiences of the people who you've known.
I always think that's very difficult to define, but my experiences of the people with who were scholars and the like in our firm were good at the admin side. They did not make jobbers. It's got to be somebody who has a flair for that particular game, and I think it's very difficult. We got one or two. I can think of a little chap called Wood we got who came from the office, who we suddenly discovered had a flair. But a great many of the people who were eventually taken over by BZW and paid large sums did not have a flair. In any firm, I'll tell you one who you probably know had a great flair at the Gilt Edge Market was Pepiot and his co-partner. They were a flair, they may be very clever too, but they had a flair. Leroy Lewis, I would have said, probably was much more on the, he's got a very good brain, much more on the admin side, and no doubt was very good at running a firm. But the market flower people were people like Brian Pepper.
Would you have said a person from any kind of background would have been able to make their way?
Absolutely.
As a jobber?
Absolutely. We had some from what you might call the upper echelons, and equally good ones from the lower one. And that was so before we were there. I can remember a chap called Rennie particularly, who had no particular background, was one of the kings of the jobbing before. So. No, I say it's entirely a question of flair, but not necessarily brains. The clever people on the whole, they used to think too far ahead. We're not usually the flair people.
Well, I think we'll finish on that note. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, I have